Our next speaker is Dr. Matthew Reynolds. He's from the CIMMYTS, that's the International Maize and Wheat Research Center in Mexico. He's an expert area in research is heat stress physiology. He's going to talk about phenotyping for heat adaptive traits.
Thank you very much, Bing Ru, for that introduction and for the invitation, of course. So, let's get started. So I acknowledge here my group in Mexico, the Wheat Physiology Group, and their names will come up during the presentation. Heat's very important. The world is getting warmer. And we obviously need to do something about that. I'm going to mostly talk about wheat, but it's not just wheat that's affected, it's everything. Here's a map. This is adapted from some work by Ramirez and Jarvis nearly 10 years ago now, but showing how different wheat environments are warming up. What you see at the bottom, these are the mega environments that CIMMYT defines for wheat, and the red dot, that's the hot spring wheat environment. So you see a few red dots, but what the disturbing thing is the number of numbers in red, in brackets in red, that are not next to red dots. This is basically telling us that a number of sites which were not formally classified as high temperature stress will be, which means a whole different approach to breeding and a whole set of traits that we are not really considering on a large enough scale at the moment. And that's what I really wanted to talk about. So basically here you see the definition. We have a bit of an arbitrary definition of heat stress, which is where the average growing season temperature is greater than 18 degrees centigrade. But of course, heat stress has a lot of different manifestations, a lot of different characteristics, patterns, and profiles. I don't really have time to get into that. But it is important to remember there are environments where heat occurs early or heat occurs late, or there are environments where the heat stress is pretty chronic. So it's not one size fits all. I have to also, I'd like to show you a little video, but I don't think it's going to work. But it basically shows how the heat shocks, that's another component, this phenomena where heat stress comes in maybe just for 3 days, but it completely will change the physiology of the plant. And this is another issue of great concern. The climatologist is telling us that these heat shocks are going to become much more frequent in the future. Anyway, here's some work that Senthold presented earlier today, and he may present again tomorrow, I think, basically showing. This is modeling of heat-stressed environments for wheat again. This is using a model ensemble, 30 different models and 30 different years of data. Basically, the outcome of this is that we will have 2 degrees higher average temperatures in 30 years' time, and each degree will be associated with a 6% decline in global wheat production. And when you consider that wheat is the most widely grown crop of any, and its productivity, that is a very huge economic impact that we can expect from that factor. We're talking billions of dollars. So actually, if we had billions of dollars to do the research, Senthold, I'm sure, would agree, we could probably solve a lot of these problems. I definitely would agree with that. Unfortunately, that's not the way the world works. That's, if any of you have a chance to see that video, that's a great one. Basically what it shows, and I'm certain it's not going to work, what it shows is how the number of environments worldwide that have had heat shocks has just increased so much over the last few decades. Okay, let me talk about some of the methods we use. This is basically a pipeline. At CIMMYT, you can't just be a physiologist, you have to link your physiology to breeding. And so this is what this pipeline is representing. And essentially, we try to design a better crop. We can use models like the one I showed. We can use conceptual models, quantitative models, simulation models. Essentially, to come up with a set of traits or a constellation of traits that will give us a better adapted plant. And I'll show you one in a little bit later. And then, of course, that will always identify traits that we need to use in breeding, and that's where the genetic resources come in. These could be land races, they could be wild relatives. And, of course, the central theme of this symposium, the phenotyping. When phenotyping is central to all of these, and high-throughput phenotyping is central to screening genetic resources because they tend to come in big numbers. Genetic analysis is important if we can find markers, especially for hard-to-phenotype traits, and also for understanding better how traits may go together in a single line. That takes us to the breeding and the delivery, and it's physiologists working in CIMIT has the pressure to deliver in the breeding context, which is of course important for validating hypotheses, but also the luxury of being able to test material at very many sites with being linked to so many collaborators throughout the world. So this is one of the environments that we can work in, or this is the temperature of our main breeding station, let's say. And these are the minimum temperatures and the maximum temperatures. And you can see by playing around with planting date, we can simulate different heat stress profiles. And here I just wanted to highlight quite an interesting one here, that obviously minimum and maximum temperatures are going up in the early part of the year. But if you're sowing here, you basically got an interesting situation. The maximum temperature is going up, but not as fast as the minimum temperature. So with that late sowing date, you've got a way to control in the field the minimum temperature. I say as far as you can control anything in the field, of course, because each year tends to be a little bit different. And we take advantage of that to sow wild species, looking for that elusive adaptation to high night temperature. And then, of course, the heat shock. That is definitely something that is tricky to control in the field. Heat shocks come along whenever they feel like it. Nobody can really predict them. But we have been working with these heat tunnels. Fairly simple idea, basically taking a frame and covering it with some plastic, which will accumulate the heat. And you can see from this graph that you're able to consistently get 2 or 3 degrees higher temperature in this tunnel, as long as you control the ends. If you close it in, you turn it into an oven and everything gets cooked. And if you leave the ends open and get some flow of air, you can control the temperature reasonably well. So with this, one can generate a heat stress at a specific growth stage, like meiosis, for example, or early grain filling, as you wish. So, I don't think we have time to go through this whole conceptual model. This was published in 2012, anyway, in Plant Physiology, if you want to look it up. Essentially, we're looking at traits that are affecting light interception. Light interception in warm conditions is so important, that early ground cover. Because the crop, for wheat anyway, goes so quickly, if you don't have good light interception early, you pay the price right through. Whereas in a more temperate environment, you don't see that. And under drought, actually, ground cover can be disadvantageous. So early ground cover for light interception is so key for high temperature. And of course, you have this phenomenon that most people here would be familiar with of stay green, functional stay green. So at the other end of the cycle, especially under high temperature stress, you'll see this. You'll see this progressive loss of chlorophyll. So these are both traits that are very easy to select for, even with your eyes and with radiometers, with the green seeker, for example. And then there are many traits that affect radiation use efficiency. Many of them are not amenable to high throughput phenotyping, like Rubisco, for example, specificity that was mentioned earlier. These and enzymes related to the Calvin cycle, none of these are high throughput, but doesn't mean to say they're not important. And I think it's worth mentioning, although we're all having a love affair right now with high throughput, it's not always feasible, and it doesn't mean it's not important, because high throughput is great for screening genetic resources in large numbers. It's great if you can apply it on early generation selection. But if you're picking parents from a subset of material that's already important, it doesn't need to be high throughput, although it needs to be affordable, of course. And so let's not assume that unless things are high throughput, they're not valuable. They still can be valuable. It's just that we're always looking at a breeding scale for the best throughput that we can get. So obviously, another one, respiration, that's a huge area. We don't, it's such a catch-all phrase, really, respiration. I mean, this, again, an area of immense ignorance, somewhere where we need to invest more in order to understand that and the consequences of respiration at high temperature on yield. Photoprotection, some traits that we can look at quite easily. Chlorophyll A to B ratio was mentioned earlier. It's something that we can measure at high throughput reasonably well with pigment indices. Carotenoids are involved in dissipation of light, excess light energy. Again, can be measured with radiometers. Downregulation has been in the news lately, and the ability to recover quickly from downregulation. And we're looking into how that might be measured using high throughput approaches. So we have light interception, we have radiation use efficiency, and of course, those two give you biomass, and that's not generally what we want. We want yield, so that's partitioning or harvest index. And there are again, many traits associated with that. Things like spike fertility. It's often said that the most heat-sensitive stage is meiosis or pollination. And from a strictly physiological point of view, that is true. But it's not actually necessarily the stage where we should be focusing most of our energy, because most crops have been bred for flowering, meiosis and flowering to occur at the coolest part of the cycle. So it's not necessarily, just because it's the most sensitive, not necessarily the trait that we should focus most of our energy on. Of course, it's still important. The plant growth regulators coming in, ethylene, for example, is being associated with progeny load and grain abortion. Dirk Hayes, I don't think he's here, but did some nice work on that over 10 years ago. This trait of accumulation of carbohydrates in the stem, I'll come back to that. Very important trait. A lot of genetic variation hasn't been fixed, and it's a way to ensure grain filling. Even if you accumulate carbohydrates in the stem in a cooler, more favorable part of the cycle, and it ensures that carbohydrates are available for grain filling later on in grain filling stage, when conditions can be extremely unfavorable, even to the point where you may not have any live leaves at all. Now, that's a few snapshot of a few important traits. You've always got to remember that not every trait is important for every environment, as I mentioned at the beginning. And the other problem, and this is what makes plant breeding fun but frustrating, is that because we have such an incomplete understanding of the genetic basis of yield, you never know what you're going to get when you throw a trait at a new background or even an allele. And so we have to remember that the G by G is always there, playing with messing with our head. So moving straight on to genetic resource screening, this is what I call our bottom-up approach to screening genetic resources. And it is in two senses of the word, because when you're dealing with these huge numbers, it's hard to be too sophisticated and too mechanized. And there are, and 70,000 sounds like a big number, but there are 0.8 million, an estimated 0.8 million genetic resources and collections around the world. That's not even one-tenth of that, and I assure you that was a major effort. It spread over several years, frustrating and hard. And I still remember the pain in my legs, because that's not one of those, it's not my bottom. I think I was taking the photo, but I did participate in that exercise. Okay, this photo is depicting some of the places where some of the genetic resources come from. This is a wheat field a Landrace wheat field in Oaxaca. Some very, very good genetic resources came from Mexico, in fact. Here's an aerial photo. You can extract information from this photo, and you can also see problems with your sewing. And so our aerial approaches give us both of those, correction and data on individual plots. The resolution is available now. But eventually you end up with a process of filtering with panels of very diverse material that can be used for breeding to increase the genetic diversity in your gene pool and research, GWAS panels and so forth. Here's one such panel, the bred wheat diversity panel at 370 inches. Here's another one, primary synthetic panel. I don't know how many of you know what a synthetic wheat is, but bred wheat is a hexaploid, so you can recreate that hexaploid by crossing durum wheat, which is a tetraploid with the wild species that those two originally came together an estimated 10,000 years ago to form bred wheat. And so that created the genetic bottleneck for bred wheat, which can be opened through creating this synthetic. And the synthetic wheat, just to give you an idea of what it's like putting a woolly mammoth next to an elephant. That's more or less what it looks like. Giles is smiling. He knows that's true. And, you know, it's recognizable as a bred wheat. It's just that it doesn't thresh and it's too tall and it may have a low harvest index because it's not well adapted. But these materials have fantastic potential. And this graph shows that. What you're seeing here is a graph of the plot of yield of these primary synthetics under heat stress against their biomass. And you're seeing a correlation, not bad. But what's interesting is that these three red dots, these are elite, semi-elite chicks. These are the best of the best that's available right now. And yeah, there's not too many lines that are beating the best of the best in terms of yield, but look at biomass. Half of those lines have more biomass by several tons than the best. And that biomass is yield potential. If you can get it partitioned into the grain, already there you've captured light interception, radiation use efficiency, and that they're the hard ones, especially the radiation use efficiency. Getting it into the grain, that's the partitioning. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's relatively easy. Your job is half done when you've got, more than half done when you've got this kind of biomass. And right there, in these genetic resources, without even trying. So tremendous opportunities. Selection tools. Never underestimate the importance of the low resolution low resolution stereoscopic spectral radiometer connected to the supercomputer, which is your eyes and your brain, the first one. Okay, very powerful. These are spectral radiometers. But problem is they're low resolution. We don't see carotenoids in the background of chlorophyll, for example. We don't see chlorophyll A to B to quantify it. But that's when you use a spectral radiometer. We don't see temperature. We don't see infrared, so we're extending the range of vision with some of these tools, and of course markers are important, especially for hard to phenotype traits. But remember that phenotyping is not just about tools. That's a mistake. You've got to have the right germplasm. This is a double haploid population, as a matter of fact. These two lines, although they look extremely different, it's basically their phenology that's driving that. Their differences in photoperiod and vernalization genes. Impossible to phenotype in a meaningful way. We need populations that can be phenotyped. And this is an example of one we developed for that purpose, Seri Babax. And of course, we're moving to aerial approaches, as I said. It's all very exciting. Everyone wants a drone. But please remember one thing. That's the easy part. I think I see a few people nodding their head. It's now the image analysis is the hard part. And just buying a drone, just because you have a budget for a drone, doesn't mean to say you can become a remote sensor. You need a budget for a technician who can do image analysis as well. And the reason that, so that's a cautionary note, the reason that image analysis and the high throughput drone based approaches give you better data than running around with a handheld instrument for two main reasons. First of all, it's a snapshot of everything. You're not facing this problem of environmental drift running around the field as the sun angle changes and the air temperature changes. You take one shot. So everything is controlled in that sense. The other is this fact that you can, with an image, you can go in and dissect it and make a frequency distribution of the pixels and remove outliers. So you're in cleaning up your data in that way as well. So some examples, I need to go fast now, so I will. So spike photosynthesis, not especially high throughput, but with this technique of covering over the spikes, it's certainly more high throughput than using an auger. And even though we built this fabulous chamber to give uniform lighting to the spike. So covering over the spikes, this gives you a highly integrated estimate of the contribution of spike photosynthesis to yield. We did it on a mapping population, identified QTLs, and then pushing HEMA to publish this result because it's very exciting. Root and canopy temperature. This has been mentioned before. Basically, you see a high association between cooler, if you have deeper roots or better root system, you have a cooler canopy temperature. Here we have a high throughput way of assessing root biomass. I don't think people really appreciate that because we're still doing shovel omics, and yeah, we need to, but we do have a way to estimate root depth at very high throughput. And I think with a little bit more effort we can, and a little bit of modeling, we can get more sophisticated than that. Perhaps with temperature, perhaps with water index as well, and timing of these events. But for now we have QTLs. I'll skip over this one, but basically what it's showing us is that the same QTLs in one environment that's dry give you deeper roots, and in a warm irrigated environment give you more roots. So the same genetic basis is giving you different expression of roots depending on where the water is. Stem carbohydrates, these were synthetic derived materials doing much better at high temperature. So this biomass that I showed you now being expressed as yield when you do a little bit of breeding, and a good association between water soluble carbohydrates and the 1,000 kernel weight in the better yielding material. And lastly, night temperature, which I started off on. Basically, you can see here two things, that as the night temperature gets warmer, this is farmer's yield, this is not experimental yield, is getting lower. But the red line is showing you that you can do something about it genetically, because that's a durum wheat that was the highest yielding and also affected by high temperature, but less so. And so this GWAS analysis showed us very clearly that if the minimum temperature, and this is now with an experimental population at 11 international sites, that the minimum temperature is what's determining the yield, not so much as the maximum temperature. Whereas for 1,000 kernel weight, it was both. Obviously, grain set is being determined to a large extent by minimum temperature, not maximum temperature, an area that we really need to understand. And when you plot the response of genotypes to different environments, some drop off drastically with warmer temperatures, some are more flat, some are just not that good. You're detecting new regions, which we need to follow up and understand what that basis is. So the last part, we put some of these principles, these traits into breeding, and we're actually getting, this is nurseries dedicated to high temperature, we're seeing very substantial genetic gains over local checks and even over our elite cimit material. So you can use physiology and phenotyping to improve rates of genetic gains. That's demonstrated, and this was clearly shown by these two genotypes, two lines that were released in Pakistan in recent years for heat tolerance, and you're seeing in their pedigrees Mexican land races and synthetics. So that's my conclusion slide. But I guess the time's up. Yeah? Okay. So just some ideas for how we can follow up for heat. We need to look at root capacity. That's obviously an important one. Very high temperature, high evaporative demand. You need a good vascular system to match that. We need to better understand this relationship between night temperature, dark respiration, and starch synthesis. we can get more out of spike photosynthesis. We need to explore the genetic diversity for all these photoprotective pigments, the water-soluble carbohydrates. And this is a tough one, but certainly worth exploring genetic resources for the Calvin cycle enzymes and Rubisco specificity. We definitely need to understand better response to heat shocks, what are the sensitive stages, and which are the ones that are most important. And we need to understand better the role of plant growth regulators in conditioning our plants to stress. These are major areas of ignorance that we need to invest in. We need to understand better the interaction of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases with temperature. We need to maintain strategic crossing pipelines using the best sources of traits, because if you think about it, there are tens, hundreds of thousands of hypotheses in the literature on heat, but how many of them have been tested in a breeding context? I could probably number them on my two hands here. So there's a big translational gap that we need to address. And we definitely need to define and refine markers for hard to phenotype traits, because not all traits are amenable. Thanks very much. Stay up here, right?
Yeah, so now we have 15 more minutes that anyone have questions for the four speakers?
I have a question for Matt Reynolds. On that night temperature response,
you repeat the question.
Mainly for the flowering and seed milk stage, or is it also an issue at the vegetative?
Well, what I was showing there was the response of yield. Okay, question was, is high night temperature important for flowering, or what stage of development? So the information I shared for in the farmer's field was yield, I don't know. We don't know, because yield is everything together, right? But for the GWAST, which also revealed the same, it was clear that your 1,000 kernel weight was more affected by both day and night temperature, whereas yield was affected more by night temperature, which therefore by deduction tells us that it was grain set. So that could be indicating, meiosis, pollination, could be a plant growth regulator response, ethylene, because progeny load is so critical that a plant determines its progeny load correctly, because if it overestimates, it can have a lot of shriveled and crap seed. And if it underestimates, it's wasting potential. So, yeah.
So I was curious to see if you could see any correlation between the increasing ambient temperature and nocturnal transpiration.
Oh. Well, I don't know. We didn't measure that. But so maybe people in the room who have. No, not.
I did.
You did? Okay, well, you tell us.
No. We can't talk about that. And what about respiration? You mentioned that, rightly so, it's a very important thing to look into. Any correlation between those increases in minimum temperatures and respiration?
We did do a study where we looked at respiration. I didn't present these results here. There was some indication that, for example, some of the land races that were showing better expression of biomass were having relatively lower respiration. But the data's a bit noisy, and you've got meshed respiration is happening 24 hours a day, every day of the cycle. Getting the right sampling methodology, that's tricky. We actually have a project at the moment where we're looking at respiration in the context of just yield potential without the heat stress. Nothing really clean has emerged so far. And I think partly because there's so many variables out there in terms of growth stage. That's not even considering different tissues, right? So growth stage, time of day, diurnal effects, different tissues. There's a lot there to be looking at. And of course, measuring respiration itself is not straightforward.
Yeah.
did. I didn't have time to explain the whole experiment, but the time zone, they actually had to use me, like, multiple times at least. So even though we did a lot of preliminary data to see the variation between the light cores, which in theory there shouldn't be any, but the reality is there is. And so we actually included that in our statistical model to estimate lab to correct for that variation.
It's beautiful, the work that you guys are doing. So if you actually, the x-rays come in before. So if you actually have a table inside the unit, and on where the roots actually need some sort of resistance,
yeah, I was
so then you have to have one part that is involved in one and change the anatomy. So what are your thoughts on actually taking this a little bit beyond the general?
Yeah, to go around.
Yeah, absolutely. The question is, how we're thinking about physical interactions and other interactions with the brain center. Oh, yeah. So with the X-rays, we were definitely developing these over time. The trick is for us is to accurately reconstruct the entire root system at each time. The gel would do that very easily. With x-ray, we're still missing some roots, but the models we're using, the computational methods we're using, to take time series of roots work just as well with x-ray models as they do with optical models. So, and we can manipulate, obviously, the substrates that we're using for x-ray imaging. So there's a number of different types of field soil, everything from field soils down to things like expanded clay and turfs and things like that. In terms of metabolic costs, I didn't show this, but with the PET imaging, we can actually see this. It was a little bit of an accident, but this was the gel, but as and we have a sort of a 5-inch diameter for this pot, and we're watching the roots growing and measuring for a given time point how much carbon is that root in. And then 24 hours later, arbitrarily, how much does it grow? And we get a pretty linear correlation for roots that are growing freely in this gel between amount of carbon, PET signal, and root growth. Until the roots start to hit the side of the jar, and then we actually see a perturbation off of that line, I think that has something to do with the metabolic cost of turning the root, or basically a brick allocation decision, if you will.
There are three species in red wheat.
Don't do it anymore.
There are three species in red wheat. Is anyone looking at the synthetics of the rafu and the sulfur yeast, or anywhere else?
Well, I think Katie might be making some of those crosses, but we haven't looked at heat yet. Well, all I can say is we haven't been seeing the component genomes of heat. So we screened a lot of neurons, and we screened a lot of cell cells, and we made new synthetics combining two sources of heat tolerance. And that, of course, is the wonderful thing about being able to make synthetics. Because if you want to do that with a species, you can't just throw the thing on genome and complex traits. You just have to know each bit to throw in. But with the synthetic, you can throw everything together in frame.
Besides that the more yielded ladders and functional aspects of the root architecture?
Yeah, besides the morphology, the function, like for the water use, water expansion, what they are doing just in the...
Yeah, absolutely. Well, water is one. Essentially, we can use stable isotopes. That's one way that we're able to make action. So for the root architectures that were shown you that are putatively enhanced or nitrogen uptake capacity, we've used stable isotopes to just measure how much nitrogen, how much nitrate and or ammonia is getting into the roots. And that's one way we can try to structure the function. But, I mean, really, we turned that on its head. In the first place, we knew that these populations, for example, the high and low protein lines in the field have these qualities. The high protein lines, we know they get more nitrogen. And so we were basically, the hypothesis was, if roots were involved, we would see differences in the root architecture because there was very strong selection for, C protein, and really the nitrogen part had to come first. So we often look at these factors. We take things with contrasting traits in the field, and if they're plausibly related to roots, we try to connect the dots with that. In terms of functional imaging experiments, you know, we can use radioisotopes, stable isotopes. We're still not a good way to analyze it into roots, actually. It seems fundamental, but it's not a good way to do it. So it's tricky.
Joaquin also. So it's kind of two questions. First, how in the micro X-ray for the nodules, for example, how much resolution does it have? Can you see inside the nodules the bacteroids, or you didn't get there yet?
We can definitely see the bacteroids. I don't know if we're able to get to cellular resolution in a living sample. That remains to be seen. It's hard to answer these questions until you have the instrument and you're using it day to day for plant sites. Right? We've done a lot of application studies, but it takes a while to learn to use these things. The data I showed you was a 4x resolution. There's a 40x objective on this instrument. Another part of the instrument that I didn't mention is it's able to do a low resolution scan, for example, in a pot, identify the regions of interest, and zoom in at those regions of interest at a much higher resolution. And that's key because if you scan the whole pot at high resolution, it would take days to scan. We generate terabytes of data a week. So we're getting into data a little too big, a little under our heads. But in this case, we can actually identify, for example, each nodule in a root system and zoom in. And bacteroids, certainly cells, remain decent.
Okay, sorry, we have just one time for one question.
My question is from Matthew Reynolds.
Who?
Matthew.
Oh.
No, I can ask like that. So I also just finished my PhD in deep tolerance. So I'm a student of Richard Talman from University of Sydney. So my question is very simple. Like always, like we are talking about genetic resources, and like as you also talk, like we are always making genetic resources into like we are putting them into a breeding program. So when we are talking about genetic resources, are you screening them under natural conditions? And like if we are talking about hexal right breed or commercial breed, like most of the time we are talking, we are just looking gene, and then we are talking, okay, if this is tolerant, like if the one in five is producing gene more than we are saying, okay, this is susceptible. And like when you are talking, when you are doing the screening under natural condition for those genetic resources, and what phase that you are saying, okay, these are tolerant,
Okay, so yeah, I mean, the point of genetic resources is not being talked to be brief here. I'd kind of like to give another half hour talk. But because that's what we feel about. Actually, you've got to use some kind of funneling system. So you start off with a lot, and you sow them, and there may not be any yield. You may just have some very green plants with a lot of biomass, but they're so poorly adapted to the local photoperiod and vernalization that you have to make a judgment whether or not that is heat tolerant, for example. And if it stays green throughout the cycle and has a nice bushy biomass,
yeah, it's got something. And so you're then going to, if you're going to use it in bringing your account to vernalize it or apply for a period appropriate to get it to the cloud so you can follow it. So yeah, it's, you have to use your judgment. But you, what you're trying to get down to, because at the end of the day, you've got to also conduct research, you've got to do genetics, you've got to be able to cross routinely. You, those you would put on one side and treat in a special way, and other material, most of the material you want to be reasonably well enough adapted to express some yield at least, and definitely a biomass, and then you would start drilling down to traits. Sometimes they show a pyramid, yield at the top, biomass, harvest index, and all the traits that come under those eventually coming to the genes. And that's the way we would approach screening genetic resources, go down that pyramid, looking for ever increasing levels of sophistication.
Okay. That is back to Angel's question.